Welcome or welcome back to Horse for Horror. I'm Mariah.
And I'm Kayla.
And this week we are talking about a murder. Oh my god, Kayla, you don't even know what it is.
No, I have no idea.
Yeah, okay, this will be good. Okay. Chillicothe, Missouri is a relatively small town located about an hour and a half northwest of Kansas City. According to the 2020 census, the town boasts a population just over 9,000, and many of its residents still earn a living through agriculture work. In a tradition dating back to the 1900s, in December, the town celebrates the end of the harvest season and Christmas by having a holiday parade. In 1990, the week of the holiday parade started out well for two farmers named Lindell Robertson and Claude Woodworth. So their harvest had been robust, which was a relief to the former high school classmates and longtime business partners. Lindell and Claude actually co-owned a few thousand acres. And their families lived in ranch houses built facing each other, only separated by a highway. So they just had to like cross a road to go see each other.
Yeah.
On the farm, life followed a familiar routine: farm work, sports practice, piano lessons, and church on Sunday. The Woodworths' seven children and the Robertsons' five had grown up playing together, and they actually, almost like co-parenting kind of, like if one parent was busy, the other family would come in, so it just seemed like a really cool situation. So on the night of Tuesday, November 13th, 1990, Lindell and his 11-year-old son Scott lounged in the living room watching TV. Rhonda, the Robertson's 15-year-old daughter, arrived home around 9:30. When the film ended, Rhonda and Scott, along with two sisters, Renee and Roxanne, who are 13 and 8, went to bed. Lindell and his wife, Kathy, stayed up to watch the news. The two were actually in their early 40s and had been together for more than 20 years since meeting as teenagers at a local picnic.
Wow.
Which is so cute. So Lindell was described as slope-shouldered and shorter than Kathy, and he had a pronounced limp, actually from a severe case of childhood polio.
I have never heard of the term slope-shouldered.
Ooh, sad, you know. That's how I imagine it. Kathy had green eyes that softened around the edges when she laughed, and she was a stay-at-home mom who liked to keep her hands busy. She fashioned Easter baskets in the spring and grew strawberries in the backyard every summer. When the news ended, Kathy and Lindell went to their room to go to bed. So, just before midnight, an unknown assailant entered the house. The person passed by the floor safe in Lindell's office where bricks of cash were stacked and left the family's dog, Goldie, undisturbed in the hallway.
The dog didn't alert?
No. The person approached the door of the bedroom and pushed it open. They raised a .22 caliber weapon and fired six shots. Kathy was struck twice, once in the skull and once in the chest, and Lindell was hit by the other four bullets.
Wow.
One bullet ripped through Lindell's cheek and actually shattered his teeth, and another lodged near his liver. So none of the children in the house heard the gunshots or the person fleeing.
Well, but like, it's a .22 caliber. It's like...
Is it little? Is it big?
It's a really tiny bullet, so it's like...
Oh, okay. Okay, that makes sense.
A .22?
Listen.
I think a .22 is smaller, so
it wouldn't be super loud.
It's so, yeah. Like, think firing range and, like, minus... Like, it's at least half as loud as...
Okay, that. Yeah, then maybe, yeah, they were all asleep. So Scott, the 11-year-old, was actually awoken from sleep by the sounds of his father groaning. So he walked across the hallway to his parents' room and flicked the light on. In the light, he saw Lyndall, naked and struggling to hold himself up against the wall. His arms and torso left streaks of blood wherever they touched, and with his mouth mangled, Lyndall told Scott to wake up his mother.
Jeez, that kid is traumatized.
Scott walked up to where Kathy laid in blood-soaked sheets and repeatedly asked his mother to get up louder and louder until he was yelling and she didn't move. So Scott's cries actually woke up Roxanne, who appeared in the hallway. Scott screamed at her to go get Rhonda, and when Roxanne ran to her sister's bedroom, or her bedroom in the basement, she screamed, "Something's happened to Mom and Dad." So the girls rushed back to their parents' room, where Scott had already helped his father into a pair of underwear. The young sisters, as well as Rhonda and Scott, maneuvered Lyndall on the floor, resting his head on a pillow so he wouldn't choke from the blood in his mouth. So terrible. Rhonda picked up the phone on the couch and called her boyfriend's house, and then 911. When Brian Alexander, who was Rhonda's boyfriend, arrived at the scene, he called the Woodworths, who's the family that lives across the road.
Mm-hmm.
So the Woodworth kids, the whole family, were all asleep, and they were spread out. Well, obviously, it's like 3 a.m. When Claude's wife, Jackie, lifted the phone, she heard Brian tell her that there was an emergency. Jackie immediately got up, told her husband where she was going, and left. Claude later recalled thinking that maybe one of the Robertson kids had, like, an appendicitis, and like, oh, it's not a big deal, you know, like, she's just going to help out for a little bit.
Wait, what?
Well, that's what, like, she was going to, like, watch the other kids.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, like, she was going, not like, you know, cut it open in the living room, but, like, take it, like, while she'll watch everyone else while they go to the hospital with one of them.
Okay.
Oh, my gosh. Obviously, when Jackie got there, she realized that something terrible had happened, so she went inside, heard the news, and immediately turned around. She went to go get Claude, her husband, and said, you know, something's terrible's happened. We all have to go over there.
I thought she was like, yeah, no.
Yeah, like, no thanks.
I'm going back to bed. It's too early for this.
Now she's like, Claude, you better fucking figure this out. So when Claude arrived at the Robertsons' home around 12:30 a.m., the paramedics and police were still rushing around the scene. Once he stepped through the door, obviously he was told about what had happened, and unfortunately all the children had to actually wait in the clothes that they had touched their parents with, so they were blood-soaked because they had to be tested, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So Claude learned that Lyndall miraculously had survived and he would continue to survive. He was airlifted to Kansas City for surgery and he wouldn't return home for several weeks, which meant that he missed the holiday parade, which was actually scheduled the same day as Kathy's funeral.
Mm-hmm. That's sad. Also, I don't know why, but when you said that, when Claude learned that he would survive, that's just kind of weird.
I know, right?
That set off alarms.
Who knows? Okay, so.
You do.
I do, but I'm not going to tell you. Word of Kathy's murder had sent a jolt through the community. So violent crime is actually uncommon in Chillicothe, but by sheer coincidence, the town was already reeling from a series of murders conducted by an elderly couple.
What?
So just 2 weeks before the Robertson shooting, Faye Copeland had been convicted in a Chillicothe courtroom of helping her husband, who was awaiting his own trial, kill several migrant workers.
Okay.
So obviously, like, rumors are going like, oh my God, what the hell? So Claude Woodworth found himself talking about the crime with other farmers at a local auto shop. It was like a bunch of the farmers just hanging out there talking about it. So among the men was actually someone named Chris Ruoff. Chris told the men that he had driven past the Robertsons' home not long before the shooting, and from Highway 190, he'd seen a car in the driveway that looked like a Ford Bronco or a truck with a camper attached. And so it was actually near the front door, which is where the visitors parked when they went to the Robertsons' house. So given the late hour, Chris had initially assumed that the car belonged to one of the daughter's boyfriends, Brian, the guy who showed up. However, Chris reconsidered this assumption, telling the other farmers that, you know what, it couldn't have been Brian because Brian had been in a car accident the month before and his vehicle was totaled. So he didn't know who it was. So Chris wasn't a dumbass, and Chris went into the sheriff's office and told the deputy about the car that he saw. Thank fucking God.
Chris wasn't a dumbass. Yeah. Good job, Chris.
Ugh. So the sheriff's department actually informed the Missouri Major Case Squad. And it was actually connected to a suspect of the murder, a teenager named Brandon Thomer, whose family had a white Ford truck with a camper. Brandon was actually the boyfriend of the Robertsons' eldest daughter, 20-year-old Rochelle, who was away at college when the shootings happened.
Okay. What the fuck? Wait. How old is this Brandon?
He is 16. And she's 20. Yes. Okay. Yeah, a little weird, but okay.
Okay. I don't understand the appeal from her side. Okay.
Same. February 10th. We were watching college basketball earlier, and I was like, these are all children. And then I thought about it. I was like, oh my God, they're like 5 years younger than me. We're all children. But yeah, I could not date a teenager when I was 20. No.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Rochelle and Brandon's relationship was rocky, to say the least.
I am shocked beyond belief, you know?
Right? What could go wrong?
Literally nothing.
Literally, yeah. Once crowned the prettiest girl at the Livingston County Fair, Rochelle had long hair and slender hips. I swear to God, that was a source.
Yeah, I believe it. The prettiest girl award.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
So Rochelle often dated boys that her mother didn't approve of, and Brandon was no exception.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Brandon was a prototypical bad boy who got into fights after drinking too much beer at high school parties.
As he's 16 years old, that's like the hardest thing he knows how to do.
He twice beat up other guys that Rochelle was dating, and when he got mad, he hit Rochelle too.
Okay.
When they broke up, as they frequently did, Brandon threatened that he would commit suicide. So Rochelle had ignored her mother Kathy's concerns about Brandon, insisting that, no surprise, she was in love. Kathy had actually had gone so far as to offer Rochelle a car if she ended things, but she still said no.
That's kind of fucked up.
Also, I would have taken that car so fast because I have no loyalty.
That is so fucked up. Like, that you're bribing your child with a car to break up with somebody? That's, I don't know that I agree with that.
Wits end, I don't know.
I guess.
So at the Hy-Vee grocery store where Rochelle worked the summer before the shooting, she had talked to her colleagues about all of her problems at home. According to her manager, LaRonda Corbin, Rochelle hated her mother and, quote, wished she was dead and wished someone would shoot her, end quote.
Oh, girl, why? Your mom seemed to love you very much.
Yeah. Later at the Brass Buckle, where Rochelle worked during college in St. Joseph, she was again candid about her relationship problems. Carrie Lehmer, who was her boss, told investigators, quote, she knew Rochelle's parents wanted them apart.
Okay, but like, your parents cannot approve of a relationship and still be good parents.
Yeah.
And also, I don't know that candid is the correct word.
What would you use?
Brutal.
Brutally honest, also, candid.
I just don't understand, like, why you would wish your mother dead.
Yeah, I don't either. So, unbeknownst to most people in Chillicothe, at the time of the shooting, Rochelle was actually pregnant with Brandon's child. So, 9 days before the shooting, on a trip home from St. Joseph, she had shown her friend Carmen the positive results of the pregnancy test.
Okay, but also, she's 20 and he's 16. Like, isn't that like
Yeah,
statutory
I
or
think that would
something?
fall under it. But I think in the 90s, a 20-year-old female and a 16-year-old male, no one would blink their eyes. And that, my
Bugs.
friends, is what we call the patriarchy. It affects men too. But anyway, she also shared the $500 estimate for the abortion she was scheduled to have a few days later in Kansas City.
Well, I mean, that's her decision. She can do that if she wants. I don't care what the Supreme Court says.
You can't tell me what to do. So Brandon had actually offered to pay for the procedure, but he'd also wavered on whether or not, like, should they go through it.
She should have it because, like, the 90s.
Ultimately, Rochelle skipped her abortion appointment, and Lindell would later tell investigators that he and Kathy were not aware of the pregnancy. However, in the weeks before the shooting, he did tell the police that he and Kathy were trying their hardest to break the couple up.
See, I just don't agree with that.
One day, Kathy called Brandon's mother, Renee, and demanded that she tell her son to stop seeing Rochelle. Kathy actually threatened to take out a restraining order if Brandon kept coming around, and she said that he needed professional help to get over Rochelle.
She's still seeing him. You can't put that blame all on him. And you can't just take out a restraining order just because. See, I don't agree with this parenting, and no wonder the girl is so mad at her mom. See, you can't be doing shit like that.
I
Even if you
don't
don't agree with it as a
know.
parent,
We don't have kids. We don't
even if I know, but like, even if you don't agree with it as a parent, like, you're going to push your kid away from
kids.
you.
Yeah, I understand that aspect. But also, like, if my kids started dating a total dirtbag who, and she's 20 and he's 16, I would do everything in my power to separate them. And I know that.
I understand why. I just think that there should have been a little more tact. I totally get why. I don't think that they should be together either, but like, I also think that it should be the 16-year-old's mom who forbids them from seeing each other.
Yeah, and Renee did not care, so she did not stop that. And Kathy kept her word, and she did file that restraining order.
And it was
It was
approved.
approved. And the night of the shooting, it was actually on the kitchen table.
It was approved, which means there's more.
Well, yeah, he hit beats the shit out of her. I don't think there needs to
Oh,
be any
yeah,
more.
I forgot.
I hate to laugh
I
about
forgot.
that, but.
But how can you? I didn't know that a mom could take out a restraining order for her daughter, who is not a minor.
Yeah, I didn't know.
That's
Maybe
weird.
Kathy just
Okay,
filed it for
cool.
them. Either way, restraining order is filed.
Yeah, that's true.
So, in the days after the crime, Rochelle's family told her to terminate the pregnancy as well as her relationship with Brandon, obviously. Finally, she fucking agreed and she called Brandon to tell him that she was taking out a protective order and that they were done.
Why tell him? Have the cops like serve him. Have the sheriff serve him.
But she wrote on the legal form that he has, quote, struck me in the past and has made frequent harassing telephone calls. She added, quote, he may have murdered my mother and attempted to kill my father, end quote. Most importantly, in the case against Brandon, Lindell himself accused Brandon of being the shooter. When he awoke at the hospital, Lindell told doctors and police that he was almost 100% sure the 16-year-old had committed the crime because Brandon was a, quote, psycho whom the Robertsons had wanted Rochelle to stop dating.
Okay, but like, you can't just be saying because it seems like you saw him, since you are technically an eyewitness. Did you see him or do you just.
But Brandon actually had an alibi. So his family had actually moved to Independence, Missouri, which is actually just outside of Kansas City, so that his stepfather could be closer to his job.
So he was about an hour or so away.
Yeah. As for the truck, Renee, Brandon's mother, simply claimed that he was not allowed to drive it, so he wouldn't be. Investigators concluded in a report, quote, "No information has been developed which can put him anywhere but home that night," and he was cleared as a suspect.
Well, his mom is his alibi, and she said he's not allowed to, so he wouldn't. But, like, also, you're technically not allowed to beat other people, but he does. So, not really a rule follower, this one.
Yeah. So law enforcement considered a few other individuals, men with personal or professional beefs with Lindell, for instance, but nothing stuck. The Robinsons' family didn't give up hope, though. They knew that eventually the person who had done this would surface. Nothing in the house had gone missing that night. The dog didn't alert, which means that robbery wasn't the motive and that the dog knew the person. So most likely whoever it was had simply wanted the Robertsons dead.
But not even just knew the person, like, they were close enough to where the dog wouldn't stir even in the slightest. So It had to be someone who was constantly over there.
So Lindell began to wonder if that someone was someone who he and Kathy had trusted, someone who lived maybe, you know, close enough across Highway 190.
Yeah.
So in early 1991, just a few months after the murder, Lindell began to tell some farmhands that Claude Woodward might have been involved in this shooting.
Damn, how are you just going to throw his name
out there? I know, with nothing. So the two men had actually taken out $100,000 life insurance policies on each other because they were business partners.
Weird.
Claude obviously denied any wrongdoing, denied doing this, and he passed a polygraph test, even though those are complete trash, so who knows what that says.
Yeah, polygraphs are so... It's so easy to pass or fail a polygraph. Like, I feel like people who are really good at lying pass them very easily. People who are not good at lying do not pass them. People who are, like, very honest and worried about everything, have anxiety, don't pass them.
Yeah.
Like, come on. Anyway.
So despite Claude being cleared, there was no saving the bond between the two men's families. In the spring of 1991, the two men actually dissolved their partnership and the farm. They actually sued each other, and Lindell kept a portion of the land, but sold his house and moved his children closer to town. So he still had land out there, but he completely left that house.
Why not just give him the land then?
Who?
Claude.
No, that bitch has got to buy it. They hate each other right now.
Yeah, buy it.
Oh, maybe he just didn't want to buy him out. I don't know.
Yeah, true.
So for the next 2 years, police made no arrest and no movement in the murder of Kathy. Eventually, rumors and mistrust engulfed the town, and the narrative of the killing and the ensuing investigation challenged the town's very idea of itself. In the middle of it all, a culprit emerged and paid the price for Kathy's murder. And that young man was named Mark Woodworth, who was the son of Claude and Jackie.
What?
So let's talk about Mark. Marky Mark.
I don't think he did it.
As a teenager, Mark was shy and awkward, with sad brown eyes and a narrow chin sprinkled with pimples. He was...
Who writes these descriptions?
I know. Okay, it's the atavist again. So I just want to call them out. Like, oh my God, these people are so... Like, they do real journalism. I like it.
Yeah.
Mark was not described as one to join clubs or sports teams. So in his free time, he preferred to work in his dad's fields and hang out with the farmhands. In 1990, Claude set Mark up with a few acres of soybeans to manage as a trial run to determine if the teenager would be a good addition to the family business. Initially, Mark flew under law enforcement's radar. His parents had said he'd been home the night of the murder, and even more than that, he was, you know, gentle-tempered and intelligent from what friends pointed out, meaning he didn't fit the profile of a killer.
Yeah.
A neighbor, George Quinn, once recalled, "I knew that boy ever since he was born. If I'd asked him to go out and handle a dying animal, Mark sure couldn't even shoot a cat out of its misery."
Oh.
Soon after the murder, investigators actually located a box of ammunition in a shed behind the Robertsons' house. The ammunition was .22 caliber shells, and just a few were missing from the box. And that was the same type used to kill Kathy, so they had thought, possibly, this could be where the shooter had got their ammunition. Because Lindell said they used to be stored away. They were never out.
Yeah, and I just want to point out that on, like, farms and rural places, 22s are kind of the go-to.
Yeah. I wouldn't know. I don't do that shit.
Like, I don't know if I should even say this. Like, growing up, that's what my grandmother would have is a .22, just because, like, it's very quiet. And then if there's, like, a coyote or anything, she could shoot at it to scare it off. And then, like, but we had tons of acres, too. Yeah. So. Anyway, it's just, I mean, it's common.
Yeah, so it's not weird, yeah.
I think. No.
The investigators actually lifted a thumbprint from the box, and they tried to find a match in the database, whatever the big one is, but there was no luck. Mark actually agreed to an interrogation, like he was fully cooperative, and he actually gave his prints, and one of them happened to be a match, which, like, he would be going all over to both of them. Both farms, like, because it's one farm. Yeah, whatever. Okay.
Yeah, I don't see that as suspicious. Like.
Yeah. Well, depending on some people, it was very suspicious.
Although, if he, like, never handled a rifle or anything like that, maybe it's a little suspicious, but it was on the box, so maybe he just moved them.
Yeah.
Or maybe he went to go get one and then decided, like, oh, I can't put this cat out of its misery, like.
Yeah, no thanks.
I don't really see that as suspicious, but okay.
When asked if he'd ever visited the Robertson shed where the ammo was found, Mark gave inconsistent statements. At first, he claimed he'd never been inside. Then he said once he'd helped pour concrete in the structure and maybe entered it a few times on the weekends.
Okay.
So a ballistics expert analyzed a bullet from the crime scene and determined that it was probably shot from the Ruger revolver found in the Woodworth home which Claude kept in his and Jackie's bedroom.
Okay, and disclaimer for everyone, it was recently, within the past, I don't know, 10 years, determined that ballistics is not actually scientifically founded. And they took all of those classes out of your degree for criminal justice. So, like, take that as you will. Mm-hmm. It's not a science. It's not exact.
So, yeah.
And it's not, it doesn't fit the burden of proof. So,
there's that. Law enforcement suspected that Mark had taken the weapon, used it, and put it back without his parents realizing. By the fall of 1993, the sheriff's office was so convinced, and they were ready to arrest Mark. At the time, he was a high school dropout, actually living at home. He was a high school dropout, but he was taking classes to get his GED and working on the farm.
Yeah. I don't think that he's a high school dropout because he's a shitty person.
Like, yeah.
I think he, from what I've heard, he probably dropped out of school so that he could spend more time on the farm and help out because that's what he wanted to do with his life.
Yeah. And he was, like, a little weird according to description. So I bet he got bullied. Police showed up outside of one of those classes on the morning of October 20th, 1993, put Mark in handcuffs, and read him his Miranda rights.
Okay.
Obviously, his parents were bewildered. As far as they knew, their son didn't have anything against Kathy, a woman who, by all accounts, was his second mom. While awaiting trial, Mark failed a polygraph test, which, whatever. But during this time, it was, they were relied on.
They were, yep, correct.
In a report dated July 18th, 1994, the test administrator wrote, quote, I advised Mr. Woodworth that he had lied to me and was responsible for shooting the Robinsons. I told him it wasn't a question of who, but rather a question of why, end quote. Mark nodded, but when asked directly why he committed the crime, he answered, I didn't.
This is on the polygraph?
Yeah, this is according to the report on the polygraph.
Polygraphs are yes or no questions.
Yeah. The administrator pressed him, reminding that Mark, quote, if he was a cold-blooded murderer and found guilty of capital murder, he could be taken and executed for the killing. But if the shooting and death were accidental, that was another situation altogether.
Okay, so two things. A, that's leading. So stop doing
yeah.
that. B, you're just striking fear into someone who's literally taking a polygraph. Which means everything that you're saying will spike their heart rate.
Yeah.
Completely inconclusive, like.
Coercion.
Exactly. And these polygraph administrators literally think that they're stopping terrorism. Like, you're not.
Yeah.
They want you to fail. It, like, gives them joy.
Yeah.
Personal experience. I'm so serious. When I took my first one, and I passed, the lady sighed really loud, and she was like, well, you passed.
Yeah.
Thanks, Becky.
Thanks, literally Becky. Was her
name. That really was her name.
That's funny. The Robertsons' relationship with the Woodwards had only grown more toxic since 1990, obviously.
Yeah, I bet.
When their partnership dissolved, Claude hired an accountant to go through the books, which Lyndall had always been responsible for. The accountant then discovered that Lyndall had siphoned cash from the grain sales and skimmed extra money from a shared bank account to purchase cars and appliances. Claude sued...
For himself?
Yeah, for just his family. Claude sued Lyndall for $150,000 in damages, but Lyndall claimed that he was innocent, and if anything, he claimed that Claude hadn't done his fair share in the partnership. Mm. Allegedly, Lyndall was upset that Claude gave Mark that little plot of soybeans to look at, and allegedly, Mark didn't yield a profit, basically, so he owed money to the farm. And so Lyndall was claiming the Woodworths didn't do their part.
You're teaching the kid.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think that you should be like, oh, it's a deficit. Like, no, it's an internship. Get over it.
And also, it's not your whole yield. If it's your whole yield, like, you made some bad decisions. So after the indictment in October 1993, a year and a half passed before Mark's case went to trial on March 13th, 1995. Does that violate his constitutional right to a speedy and fair trial? I don't really know. Anyway.
You know, I always think that it takes way too long for it to get to trial. Yeah. Especially if they hold you without
bond. Without bail, yes.
The fuck?
Yeah, it's really fucked up.
It is really fucked up.
So Mark was tried as an adult, though he'd been a minor at the time of the shooting.
That's bullshit.
During the trial, Mark's lawyer, a man named James Wiersch, I think is how it's said, honed in on the clear absence of motive, right? So James told the jury, quote, I will submit to you that a 16-year-old boy with no motive whatsoever trying to get on in life did not shoot this individual, end quote.
That would have been enough for me on the jury.
Yeah.
Not guilty.
James attempted to present evidence concerning Brandon Thomer's relationship with Rochelle Robertson and his possible motive for wanting the Robertsons dead.
Yeah, I'd say he has more motive than Mark.
Yes. But the prosecution objected, and the evidence was almost entirely excluded.
What?
So the judge ruled that the evidence showing that someone else had a motive and opportunity to commit the crime can be admitted only if there is direct evidence connecting the other suspect to the crime.
No, you prove that with Brandon's trial.
Yeah. Well, the judge held that despite the fact that investigators found gun residue on Brandon in the days following the murder, that was not enough.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah, no, that's fine. Whatever. Also, it sounds like if there's this many questions as to who did it, maybe there should be a further investigation.
Yeah. The judge also ruled that Lindell's statement at the hospital identifying Brandon as the assailant were not direct evidence because Lindell had denied making those statements in the weeks or in like the years since.
What do you mean he denied?
He said that he didn't do that.
He didn't say that it was Brandon?
Yeah, he went back.
But he did
backtracked.
Say it was Brandon. Mm-hmm.
That's what I believe. Okay. Who knows? As for the fingerprint on the box of the 22 shells in Lindell's shed, it could have been left there when Mark went target shooting with some of the farmhands or when he was moving things around.
Okay.
The prosecutor, Kenny Holshoff, wow, addressed motive while questioning Lindell on the stand. Hadn't the Robinsons been angry at Mark for paying expenses associated to the soybean crop? Lindell said yes. Kenny also asked if it wasn't it possible that Mark had decided to shoot his neighbors to keep them quiet about his failure to pull his financial weight because he wanted to be involved in the farm business. Lindell responded, possibly.
No.
For his part, For his part, Mark testified that he didn't even know that they were upset about the soybeans because it wasn't that much. So he was like, I didn't even know they were upset with me.
Yeah, the fuck? Shut up. Like, it's not that serious. Dude probably dropped out of school to put more effort into this farm and what, his one little tiny failure?
Yeah.
Like, that's not gonna... That's... Nope. Just no.
After close to 11 hours of deliberation, the jury found Mark guilty of murder in the second degree. Burglary,
what?
Assault in the first degree, and 2 counts of armed criminal action. The judge sentenced him to 31 years in state prison.
Okay, tell me he got out on appeal.
2 years after that conviction, an appeals court reversed the verdict on the grounds that the judge had improperly excluded evidence about other suspects' potential motive and opportunity.
Yeah.
Mark was actually...
It took 2 years. That's so annoying.
He was actually released from prison and went home to await trial, which actually took place in 1999.
Okay. This is far too long.
Yeah, it's fucked up. Like, he, like, literally can't move on. You have a constitutional right to a speedy trial. Is this speedy?
And so, and this happened in what, 90? 91?
90.
90? Mm-hmm. Yeah. 9 years later?
93, he was convicted. 99 is when the second one started. Oh, sorry, he went to trial in 95. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. Arrested in 93, sat for 2 years. 95 was the trial, yeah.
Yep.
My anxiety could never.
Yeah.
Like, how do you go about your day-to-day life?
You don't, because once it...
How do you plan for your future?
Once it has its claws in you, it doesn't let go, man.
See, this is why I don't like our criminal justice system.
But also at the same time, I mad respect for it. Definitely the best in the world. It just doesn't work like it's always supposed to.
Yeah, I just think that it could be...
Could be better.
A lot better. I think that for how, great we think our justice system is, like, and how great we think America is, which I'm not saying that it's not... Definitely. I think that we should be better.
Yeah. Yeah, we can be.
I think that we should strive to be better. Like, there are so many, like, very clear discrepancies and, like, very unjust things in our criminal justice system that I think needs to be, like, I can't believe that we're still dealing with them. Like, someone could have very clear evidence that somebody else committed a crime and the person convicted of it wrongly still won't be able to get out of prison. Like, that, yeah. How is that?
Allowed.
How is that even real? Yeah. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
And where, and currently we're trying to make it harder to, like, get out on appeal. Like, we don't allow a lot of evidence in appeals court.
And cops don't even have to read evidence is
evidence, so.
Yep. It's great. I love conservative Supreme Court. How can we determine
that? Yeah, I just, like, I feel like, I'm just baffled. I'm baffled that this is real, but okay, yeah.
So since the first trial, Kenny Holshoff, whatever, had recently been elected to Congress after campaigning on his record of locking up violent criminals.
Wow, good for you.
So another prosecutor got to argue the case this in front of the same judge who presided over the first trial.
Wait, if appeal already determined that the case was thrown out due to the judge, why do we have the same judge?
Yeah, great question, Kayla. No idea why, because
I think that should immediately warrant another appeal, like,
yeah.
Conflict of interest.
Well, didn't happen. So the Woodworths actually hired a new lawyer, too. And according to the family and a paralegal who spoke under oath, their new attorney struggled to even remember where he placed the keys. So they just had bad representation.
I feel, okay.
Yep. At trial, the new defense attorney questioned Brandon, who maintained his alibi with support from his mother and his sister's testimony, as well as Lindell, who described his initial accusations of Brandon as purely speculative.
Well, that's correct. It was purely speculative.
Once again, Mark was convicted, and this time the judge gave him the maximum penalty, which was 4 life sentences plus 15 years.
How does 4 life sentences, how is that? Like,
1 life sentence is 60 years. So you go.
No, I get that, but why did he get 4? So even if he did do all of this, one person died, and it was one attempted murder. So one murder, one attempted murder. That should be 2 life sentences.
Yeah, agree.
Where do the other 2 come in?
Agree. Because it's Missouri. We love to prosecute people.
Yeah, and that proves my point that it was a conflict of interest because the judge was just trying to fix his reputation, and so he gave him even more. Like, shouldn't that be considered cruel and unusual punishment?
Unjust, yeah.
Or the punishment does not fit the crime.
Yeah. Great thinking. But let's remember, it's 1999. And criminal justice reform is still has a long way to go.
Still working on it, yeah. Yeah.
And Mark remained in prison. He passed time by welding metal cabinets, rehabilitating rescue dogs for adoption, and praying in the chapel. His family firmly believed in his innocence. Jackie, his mother, coordinated weekend visits to the prison, staggering various siblings' and relatives' times with him. On the 2 weekends each year when visitors could bring food to prisoners, Jackie made Mark's favorite, which was lasagna, corn casserole, and peanut brittle. Every August, the women in Jackie's Sunday school class sent Mark birthday cards, and at home, Jackie kept his bedroom the same way he'd left it, with a quilt neatly smoothed over the bed.
Oh, I feel really bad for that family.
Yeah. So in 2008, a man named Bob Ramsey began working for the law offices of Michael Bilbrey, which was a 15-person firm across the Mississippi River from St. Louis. Ah.
Okay.
At the time, the attorneys took on workplace injuries cases, specializing in claims of asbestos poisoning. When Bob arrived, he didn't really fit into the culture. He was a defense attorney and a journeyman who'd roamed all over St. Louis for 2 decades. He actually worked at large and small firms and even tried his hand at private practice. So Bob Ramsey had a big soft spot for underdogs and what he sometimes referred to as 10-foot pole cases, which were cases that were so unwinnable other lawyers wouldn't touch them.
Oh, good. I like this guy.
Yeah, you're about to like him even more. So Bob Ramsey had inherited his conscience from his father, Brooks, who was a Southern minister or Southern Baptist minister. In the early 1960s in Albany, Georgia, Brooks Ramsey used his pulpit at the First Baptist Church to advocate for desegregation, much to the hatred of some of his own congregants, including members of the Ku Klux Klan, and one man who nailed a 95-point doctrine on white supremacy to the church's door.
Ugh. But also, yay! Good for Bob.
Yeah, Brooks is a good guy. His dad's a good guy, and Bob's a good guy. In 1962, Brooks Ramsey took his son, who was then 14, to see the famed Martin Luther King Jr., to deliver a sermon on racial tolerance at a black church. The next day, King Jr. was actually going to do the same at Pastor Ramsey's congregation, but when the civil rights leader arrived, he was met by an angry crowd that prevented him from entering.
So annoying.
It was actually so bad that a riot ensued, and it actually caused the National Guard to come out.
Jesus.
And that night, a cross was staked in the Ramsey's home, of course, lit on fire.
Great. Guess who did that?
At school the next day, Bob Ramsey arrived to find the N-word lover scrawled in big letters in a chalkboard of his homeroom.
So fucking childish.
Yeah, so soon after, his family actually left Georgia, and Bob later recalled, quote, "It made me question the whole religion, how the church always told us that everyone is equal in the eyes of God, and then to treat whites and blacks so differently," end quote.
Let's also keep in mind that still happening.
Yeah.
That religion is still preaching equality and tolerance and being the most intolerant.
Yeah.
To people who don't fit their little norms.
Which isn't even the norm.
Not all of them, but like...
some.
Yeah, and the minorities are louder than...
yeah. Yeah, that's really important to remember, too. The tiny minorities really loud.
Yeah.
So once Bob began practicing law, he made a name for himself by mounting cases to free women imprisoned for killing their abusive husbands. Mm-hmm. He also took on...
so interesting.
He also took on what he believed to be wrongful convictions. In one instance, he embarked on a freedom march from St. Louis to Kansas City in honor of a woman whose original lawyer had been paid off by her boyfriend and co-defendant, forcing her to take the fall for a murder that she didn't commit.
Oh, great.
Mel Carnahan, the governor of Missouri, had actually pledged clemency for the women, but he eventually, well, don't let me say eventually, he died in a plane crash before he could do so. And Carnahan's successor made no such offer. Ramsey, who represented the women, decided to go on the 5-day, 170-mile walk to draw media attention to her appeal. Among the people who saw Bob's bold stunt was a state lawmaker who'd been particularly interested in what he believed to be another miscarriage of justice, this time in Chillicothe. He asked Ramsey to look at the case, and Bob did one better. He agreed to represent the defendant, Mark Woodworth. Woodward.
Pro bono, right?
Yeah. Also, I've probably said the name Woodworth 15 times, but it's Woodward. Woodward. Yes. But yeah. We all know. I'm really sorry. Importantly, Bob Ramsey actually partnered with a woman named Kelly Williams, who was hired as an administrator at the law firm. Kelly was a 35-year-old single mom of two, and in her 20s, she'd worked as a blackjack dealer at the Alton Bell, which is a riverboat casino on the Mississippi.
Didn't someone else work there?
In this case?
Yeah.
No?
Weird.
Yeah, isn't that strange? Missouri's so stupid.
Missouri really
it's
is
like,
stupid.
That's so ridiculous. Kelly stood just over 5 feet tall, smoked a pack of marbles a day, and had a brash, infectious laughter. She was described as good at her job, organized, quick, and intuitive, but she also was outspoken, which made her, you know, not the job's favorite, or not her boss's favorite, which put her to the point that her job was on the line.
Yeah.
But Bob liked her, and she had worked with him on a few settlement cases, and he was impressed with her. And he actually, when she was about to be fired, he stepped in and took her on as his assistant for the Woodward case.
Good.
One day in 2010, Bob and Kelly got a phone call from an Associated Press reporter named Alan Zagier. While working on a profile of Kenny Holshoff, the prosecutor in Mark's first case, Alan had discovered something really interesting. So Kenny was actually running to be Missouri's next governor, a race that he lost, and Alan had stumbled across documents pertaining to Mark Woodworth, Jesus, that had never been discussed in court. In fact, the documents didn't appear in any case files, suggesting that they'd never made it to Mark's lawyers. If so, this represented potentially exculpatory evidence.
What were these documents?
I'm glad you asked. So these documents were letters dating back 15 years between Kenny Holshoff, Judge Lewis, and Lindell Robertson.
Interesting.
In one of the letters, Lindell declared at one point that he was adamant that Brandon Thomer be charged with the crime. In another letter, Lindell said that justice would not be served until evidence against Mark was brought to a grand jury, which indicated that Lindell was swaying the judge.
So, you think Lindell probably just changed from Brandon to Mark just to get back at Claude?
And he was just like, I mean, he wanted his wife's murder solved. Like, I would want someone in prison too, but you can't, you have to do it legally.
Yeah, the right person. Yeah. The right person. Like, I get it. Your wife was murdered and you were fucking probably mangled due to this.
Yeah.
Like, you're traumatized. I get that. I would never want someone who did not do that crime to go to prison, especially someone who, it seems like Mark is a really nice person. And, like, really just, like, gentle person. Why on earth would you do that to him and someone that you
were
considered his family for the longest time?
Yeah.
That is so malicious.
And you watched Mark grow up. Like, I don't know. I just don't know how you, I don't know.
Yeah, so you basically just did that to your own son, almost.
Yeah.
I just don't agree with it. And I think that that's malicious. And I think that he should have gone to therapy and like figured that shit out. Like,
eventually Bob and Kelly filed an appeal, this time based on the documents, which had begun to be known as the Lewis letters, which that's named after Judge Lewis, who's a shitty judge. The pair attempted to make the case that Mark hadn't received a fair trial because Judge Lewis had abused his power and acted beyond the purview of his role by excluding evidence of a separate suspect. And they also asserted that Lindell wielded influence over the choosing of the grand jury. So he even attempted to influence that portion.
That is so dirty. I don't really know what word to use, but I don't like that.
Yeah. Eventually, the appeal reached all the way to the Missouri Supreme Court, and in 2010, the judges ruled in favor of Mark and put his case on their docket. So they assigned a special master to the case, someone named Judge Gary Oxenhandler, to preside over the hearings where lawyers would present evidence and question witnesses. So the hearings wouldn't lead to a verdict, Rather, Oxen Handler would submit a report to the Missouri Supreme Court, which they would then use to rule on whether Mark's constitutional rights had been violated.
Which they have.
Yeah. Bob and Kelly managed to gather nearly 200 pieces of evidence to submit during the hearing, much of it pointing to faulty police work and an undue focus on Mark.
That's a lot of evidence.
They also found a lot of evidence that they weren't expecting that pointed to Brandon being guilty. Although, it was all circumstantial, which wasn't enough for the prosecutors to build their case on.
Maybe that's why they switched.
But still, at this time, they hoped to use it to at least air what they'd learned about Brandon.
Yeah.
In 2006, Brandon had been sentenced to 6 months in jail for drunk driving. 3 years later, Sandy O'Connell, who was the mother of a young woman who was pregnant with Brandon's child, approached police near the town of Lake Ozark, where Brandon was living. She told the police, quote, "He has beaten on my daughter. Brandon has personally threatened to kill me and has told me that he would kill me and my white trash family," end quote.
Well, that sounds pretty familiar.
Yeah. Police in Jefferson City received an abuse complaint against Brandon, this time from one of his neighbors of his then girlfriend, Amanda. The way he just looked around was so funny. I was like,
sorry, I'm just trying to figure out where the heck this cat is.
You were like this, you were like, so funny. An officer observed in a report that Amanda's, quote, "left eye was starting to turn black and blue," which she said was from Brandon punching her. When she tried to get away from him during the altercation, quote, "he slapped her and threw her on the floor." Bob and Kelly also discovered evidence that another individual, a man named Aaron Duncan, had approached law enforcement and said that Brandon had bragged about, quote, "being the number one suspect in a murder investigation that had gone on a long time."
Wow, that's... that... okay.
One night in 2008, Aaron had gone over to Brandon's house and the two men were drinking in the garage when Brandon started to rifle through some old boxes. In the boxes were some of Brandon's wrestling trophies, but Brandon was more interested in newspaper clippings from the time when he told Duncan that he'd been accused of murdering his girlfriend's mom.
Yeah, he kept newspaper clippings?
Yes!
Those are trophies.
Aaron told police that Brandon said her parents had wanted her to stop seeing him. Brandon said they fought all the time, this and that, him and her parents, and they thought he was too aggressive for her. Brandon also talked about, quote, "someone named Mark," Duncan stated. "He was really talking down about this Mark guy, like how stupid he was," end quote.
That sounds like some serial killer behavior.
I fucking know.
The trophies.
Yeah.
Because people who just, like, commit, like, a one-time murder usually will not keep trophies like that. Like, they want to stay away from it because they don't want to be caught. But, like, serial killers?
Yeah, get involved.
Their minds work a little differently. Maybe he is a psychopath.
Yeah. So 2 weeks after the conversation in the garage, Brandon came up to Aaron and asked for a $5,000 investment in MMA. Like, how close are you that you asked for $5,000, bro? That's just absurd.
Completely unrelated, Mariah. Can I have $5,000?
Yeah, so yeah. I just, like, I want to open an MMA gym. Like, you know, I have a love of it. So, it's fucking insane. Aaron had young kids at home and money was tight, so obviously he told Brandon, like, no, I can't help you out. He later claimed that Brandon, quote, flew off the handle. When Duncan told Brandon to calm down, Brandon threatened to kill him and his family, stating, quote, "I killed before and got away with it. What makes you think I can't do it again?" End quote.
Okay, that was an admission.
Yeah. Dude, and that was all said at court, or it's all going to be presented at court.
Okay, good. Wild.
The evidentiary hearing began on May 31st, 2011, which was Mark Woodworth's 3,498th day in prison. Bob and Kelly's plan was to petition Jug, wow, Jug, Judge Oxen Handler for habeas corpus relief, which would free Mark on the grounds that he hadn't received a fair trial.
Yeah.
To Bob, the case against his client represented a manifest injustice, and he would call up to, or he would call 30 witnesses to prove it, including Brandon. Bob methodically presented evidence casting suspicion on Brandon, the contradictions of his alibi, threats against Kathy Robertson, and the confession that he made to Aaron Duncan. Brandon was called to the stand, and each time he answered a question, he pled the fifth. Which, well, that is your right.
He has, yeah, that is your right, but, like, he had motives. Did he have a means?
I don't know.
The truck?
The truck, yeah.
The Bronco?
The truck, yeah, that an eyewitness, like, saw?
So, yeah, it's, like, all really circumstantial, but also the fact that his alibi is his mother, who didn't say, oh, yeah, I saw him all night. She said, no, he's not allowed to drive the truck, so he wouldn't.
Yeah. Like, and he's listened so well before, honey.
And he was 16, a 16-year-old bad boy. Yeah, okay, yeah.
And the dog sure didn't alert. He's gonna listen to you. So he was around the dog. Like, ugh.
I don't know. I think that if his would have gone to trial, it would be pretty much beyond a reasonable doubt that he did it.
Yeah, depend on his Brandon defense. That'd have to be a pretty good defense. Yeah. The prosecution, however, argued that the only question at stake was whether there was any evidence to consider. They planned to show that all the exhibits Bob had basically gathered, the Lewis letters, had all been available to Mark's previous attorney, and if his past counsel had made poor decisions with that evidence, the state wasn't to blame. Which, fair.
Yeah, sure, like, as far as, like, posting blame and shit, yeah, but, like, let him the fuck out.
Before Brandon was dismissed from the case, Oxen Handler waved Brandon's attorney to the bench, turned off his microphone, and told him, quote, as an officer of the court, I want you to be aware that there is a warrant for your client's arrest out of another county. When he leaves the courtroom, he is going to be arrested. End quote.
What's the warrant for? He's been in prison for 10 years.
No, this is Brandon. It's for Brandon.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Sorry.
Outside the room's doors, right after Brandon walked off stand, the officers arrested him for writing a bad check. They read it. Wow. They read him his rights, patted him down, and emptied the contents of his pockets. Among the items was an index card on which Brandon's lawyers had written, quote, if you forget, just shut the fuck up. I don't know why that's funny, but it's just funny.
That is funny. But, I mean, seriously.
Yeah, shut the fuck
seriously
up.
Seriously, though. Like, just
don't
shut
talk
up.
To them. Don't talk to them. Never, like, even if you're
we
guilty.
We want Brandon to talk so that, yeah, I agree. But, like, obviously we want Brandon to talk so that Mark can get out. But, like, also shut up.
Yeah. In May 2012, 1 year after the hearing, Judge Oxen Handler released his report. He found that the prosecution had failed to disclose the letters and police reports to Mark's defense, and that Mark was entitled to a new trial. Oxen Handler criticized the focus on Mark as a suspect when there was, quote, an open and obvious other person who could have committed the crimes. The judge also criticized, quote, an apparent pattern of not following up on witnesses and investigative leads that tended to contradict Brandon's statements, end quote.
Yep.
The judge also...
Love that police work.
The judge also wrote that he was, quote, hard-pressed to come up with a word or a phrase in the English language that fairly describes the conflicts that existed with regard to Woodworth's judicial process. Jesus Christ, they could be the lyrics to a country and western song, end quote.
What the fuck?
Yeah. In January 2013, the Missouri Supreme Court upheld oxen handler's finding and they vacated Mark's conviction and ordered a new trial.
Okay, thank you, but like, don't order a new trial. Leave him alone.
The next month, Mark was released on bond, and in July 2014, after a special prosecutor was appointed to review the case, the charges against Mark were dismissed.
Good. Thank you.
He went on to live as a free man, and he eventually married a woman named Caddy, or I'm assuming that's Katie, with whom he shares one child with.
So did he get some money? Because he spent 10 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit.
I don't think he got any money from the state of Missouri.
Because the state of Missouri said it's not Missouri that did it. It was the lawyer. I'd sue the fuck out of him for false imprisonment.
More than a quarter century, two trials, and tens of thousands of pages of legal documents after Kathy's murder, with the Robertsons still sure that Mark committed the crime, it's likely that only a signed confession, or the murder weapon will lead to charges. And because virtually no one involved in the case has ever admitted wrongdoing, and the investigation by Judge Oxenhandler into Mark's appeal was to prove his innocence, not convict someone else, the answers to several questions remain out of reach.
So the person that did the investigation that dismissed the charges against Mark should have investigated charges against Brandon.
But that wasn't the peer view of that, whatever, that trial, that little mini trial that they had. That's what they were saying, like, Oxenhandler, that wasn't to look at Brandon, that was to clear Mark, which, fucking fair, like, Mark should be out of prison, but also, like, Kathy deserves justice, right?
Yeah, there's a two-parter here.
Yeah. So if Brandon was the shooter, why has there never been any physical evidence found to implicate him? How likely is it really that a 16-year-old, no matter how volatile, could get away with murder, particularly after being named the first suspect by the surviving victim? And also, like, what if someone else is responsible for Kathy's murder? A suspect that was completely missed, you know? That's not out of the question.
And, like, look at her kids. Like, her kids don't have any closure for that.
Yeah.
Can you imagine, like, spending 10 years thinking that the person that killed your mother was in prison only to have them get out?
Yeah, you would think a murderer is on the loose. That's probably what they think, yeah.
That's probably exactly what they think, yeah.
So if you or someone you know has any information regarding the murder of Kathy Robertson, please contact the Livingston County Sheriff's Department at 660-646-0515. And that is the murder of Kathy Robertson.
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that, like, we started this case initially with the murder of Kathy.
Yeah, at the end of the day, there's still no justice for Kathy.
Yeah. Yeah, I know that, like, I get mad about the injustices and stuff and, like, Mark spending his, like, 10 years in prison when he shouldn't have. But at the end of the day, like, the case is about Kathy. Like, she's dead and we don't know why.
We have no idea why, because a bunch of people became really focused on one guy. Like, that's an injustice. Yeah. That is an injustice.
Yeah.
Which really fucking upsets me. But, hey, we hope you guys enjoyed it. So far, we're loving season 3, and we've stayed on schedule, so we hope you guys stick around.
Yeah, and, like, stick around through my mic issues. I don't know what's happening, but...
We'll solve it. We'll solve it, whatever.
We will solve it. Maybe I'll get a new mic. Oh. Although I have a pretty good mic.
So yeah, you have a really nice one, yeah.
Yeah, so...
But we'll be back in 2 weeks. Love you guys. Bye!
Bye!